This is the 21st. I'm Dana Cronin, in for Brian Mackey today. The agriculture industry looms large in Illinois, and increasingly, farmers here are dealing with some pretty bizarre weather. The United Nations recently released a report on climate change that showed that agriculture will be among the hardest hit industries worldwide, and is also one of the top contributors to climate change. Those facts lay the foundation for Hot Farm, a new podcast from the Food and Environment Reporting Network, which, full disclosure, I helped to report and produce. For those who don't know me, I'm the agriculture and environment reporter here at Illinois Public Media. Hot Farm takes place in the Midwest, and many, if not most, of the farmers it features are based right here in Illinois. Before we dive into a conversation with Hot Farm's host, Eve Abrams, we wanted to give you a taste of the podcast, what it sounds like, and what questions it deals with. So we're going to play a clip from episode 2, which is titled Enlisting the Unconvinced. This episode focuses on conventional farmers, the ones who primarily grow corn and soybeans here in Illinois, and how they fit into the climate change fight. Before we start, a little scene setting. In this snippet, I'm on a bike ride with a conventional farmer named Lynn Warfel. He's a fourth-generation farmer who grows corn and soybeans outside of Champaign. In this clip, we had just ridden our bikes to Mike Wishall's house. He's Lynn's neighbor, also a conventional farmer. Lynn knew I wanted to talk to farmers about climate change, so he kicked off the interview. Okay, here it is.
Mike, they're interested somewhat in the change in climate, and you've been around here for a long time. Do you have any observations on climate change?
I don't know if the climate change is climate change or if it's just trends or the way things evolve over hundreds of years.
He's saying the climate has always been changing. I hear this from farmers a lot, that contrary to what the scientific community overwhelmingly says, we're simply in the middle of a normal fluctuation in a long-term climate cycle. And this idea has a sidekick. People are not to blame for our increasingly hot Earth.
Do I believe that I caused all of it? No. There's things that happen that we don't control.
Polls show that most farmers believe the climate is changing, but most don't believe that humans, that they, are contributing to it. I hear this from other farmers, including Lynn, all the time.
I believe there is climate change. I don't know what portion of that is human-caused or natural.
I mean, there's nothing I can do to control it, so.
Yeah, we don't really talk about climate change as much as how do we do a better job raising pigs.
Farmers just want to farm. Climate change may be a priority for a lot of people, but most farmers are unconvinced. So enlisting them is tricky. Part of the problem is that climate change doesn't look as dire here as in other parts of the country and the world. There are no massive wildfires here, no hurricane season or sea level rise. There are eye-popping floods and drought, but so far, nothing particularly life-threatening. Plus, many farmers can afford to lose the occasional crop thanks to government assistance. The USDA provides billions of American tax dollars every year to subsidize crop insurance. They shell out even more money when farmers are impacted by severe weather or even market fluctuations. In fact, from Lynn and Mike's perspective, a cornfield in the middle of Illinois, a warmer climate doesn't sound so bad. It doesn't sound bad from the perspective of an atmospheric scientist either.
We've observed since the 1940s that we're about 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in our overnight lows during the growing season.
That's Eric Snodgrass. Let's stick with him for a minute. Snodgrass predicts weather for farmers so they can decide when to plant and when to harvest. He says for farmers, rising Midwest temperatures are a good thing.
That's helped expand the frost-free season. So actually, our farmers in Illinois have an advantage to planting a little earlier because of that long-term change.
That long-term change, a hotter Earth, equals a longer growing season. He says another way the climate's changed, rain.
We've also gotten quite a bit wetter on average. Now, this isn't every year, but on average, we're about 5 inches total rainfall wetter during our growing season than we were back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Crops love sun and water, up to a point. And so these climate changes...
We would consider those changes that we've observed for the last 70 years to be a net positive.
Net positive for farming. And lots of farmers are taking note.
So like silver lining of climate change, if it just keeps getting warmer, okra is just going to be so happy.
I just feel like if in 5 to 10 years I can grow mangoes and kiwis and bananas here in Missouri, I won't be too torn up about it.
Che fruit, also known as Chinese watermelon, it's borderline too cool of a climate for it, but the trend is that it'll be a lot easier to grow probably 10 years from now.
And hey, if I can buy tropical fruit at my local farmer's market, you won't hear me complaining. More sun and water means you can grow more things, and more of the things we're already growing. Bigger yields means more money, and farmers need to worry about their bottom lines. So if they might benefit from climate change, why would farmers like Lynn and Mike fight it? That was a clip from a new podcast called Hot Farm from the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Now, as you heard, that episode was reported by me, but we're going to turn now to the host of the four-part podcast, Eve Abrams. Hey, Eve.
Hello, Dana.
Eve, you conceived of this podcast and have been working on it for more than a year now. What was the goal going into this project? What kind of story did you want to tell?
Well, my mandate was to tell a story about climate change that happened in the Mississippi watershed. And so I just started talking to people and trying to learn about this region of the country. I actually live in New Orleans at the bottom of the Mississippi, but that's pretty much my main connection with the, you know, vast swath of the country that is part of the Mississippi watershed. And because I'm an audio storyteller, I knew just, you know, the elements of a good story that I wanted. I wanted to have characters that were really, you know, wonderful to listen to and had lives that we could empathize with. And I wanted there to be tension because that's what makes a good story. And I wanted to learn. So I just really, you know, started nosing around and finding out things. And everybody kind of kept pointing to farming and telling me, hey, if you want to tell a story about climate change in this region of the world, it's got to be about farming.
So we just got a taste of what Hot Farm sounds like, but that clip was only from one of the episodes, which, as I said, focused on conventional farmers here in the Midwest. Another one features the not-so-conventional farmers living and working here. Eve, can you tell us a little bit about episode one?
Yes. So this is the episode that I produced. And it really features, I spoke to, dozens of farmers and spent days with about 8 farmers in Missouri and Illinois. But even before I got on the plane to land in St. Louis, I kind of knew that Dave Bishop was going to be my main character. I really felt that in my bones. So Dave is not so far from you. He's about an hour away. He is 71, and he has been a farmer almost his entire life. He grew up on a farm near Peoria, Illinois, and he went to college, became a pilot, and then a few years later, he started his own farm in 1978. And his farming story is really the story of, you know, 20th century farming in this country. He grew up on a diversified family farm, but when he became a farmer, he farmed commodity crops, corn and soybeans. And then something pretty cataclysmic weather-wise happened to Dave, and he changed course. And kept doing that, adapting to what was practical for him to remain a farmer, which pretty much dovetailed with what is good for his soil, the environment, and as we're learning, climate change. So I focused in on Dave, and I tell his life story. And then I also get into some of the methods that he uses as a farmer and that other farmers use as well, that are farming in ways that are resilient, that are better for our supply chain, better for people, better for the soil, better for the climate.
What are some of those techniques? Can you get into that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they're not going to be so revolutionary for your listeners, but you know, the main one that we talk about is cover crops. Basically, in order to get carbon dioxide out of our air, all you really need to do is plant more. So planting cover crops would be a huge boon if more people did it. As you reported in your episode, I think it was 4% of US croplands use cover crops. So that means that 96% of US croplands are uncovered, bare naked, about, 6 months of the year. So they're not pulling carbon dioxide out of the air. And they are also leaving the soil very vulnerable to the elements, to runoff, to rain, to, they're just, it's unprotected, it's uncovered, uncovered soil. So it's a lost opportunity in terms of climate change. And it's also a lost opportunity in terms of strengthening the structure and the health of our soil, which is good for growing anything, including the crops that you sell for money. So that's the number one method that we explore, is planting cover crops. Number two is not tilling your land. So again, what plants do is they suck carbon dioxide out of the air and they hold it in their own bodies, but they primarily put it in the soil. I can't remember. I think this is also from your episode, but much more carbon dioxide is stored in the soil than in plants. So when you till the ground, when you upset the soil structure, you release that carbon into the air. Plus, as you talk about in your episode, Dana, you leave that land vulnerable to soil erosion, to runoff. So not tilling is great, both in terms of mitigating climate change, but also in terms of having healthy soil, healthy, productive farmlands at less cost, less expense.
I want to play a clip from your episode, Eve. This clip features Dave Bishop, who you mentioned is kind of your main farmer voice. He owns Prairie Earth Farm near Bloomington. Here it is.
It took tens of thousands of years for Dave's soil to become so rich and productive. Its nutrients from glaciers and silt and prairie grasses that once covered the Midwest, decomposing rich organic matter, are what make the Midwest so fertile, that whole America's breadbasket thing. I reached down to touch Dave's soil. It's dark brown, slightly gritty.
You are touching the flesh of God. That's kind of how I think about it.
As you've no doubt noticed, Dave is passionate about soil. It's his livelihood, his farm, but it's also the foundation for everything, for all life.
It's just a fascinating thing to think how this all came to be and how many thousands of years it took to create that and how quickly you can screw it up. Wow, you know, nature takes time to build something, people can tear it down, and then wonder why they can't just fix it overnight.
One of our texting group members wrote in and they said, quote, "We don't think agribusiness in Illinois is doing enough. There needs to be more incentive to plant cover crops. Support is always needed when people are changing age-old habits." And another wrote in, quote, "Farmers could do more, but most certainly need not only government assistance, but public support. Even in the short run, it increases costs." Eve, I wonder how these texts that we receive jive with what you heard from some of the farmers that you spoke with.
Oh, 100%. I agree with that. I mean, farmers have to make their businesses a go or they're bankrupt, you know, so they can't go out on a limb and do something that is financially risky. And the more that our government programs can support them doing things, pursuing practices that are good for not only their farms, but the planet, the better. And I think currently our structures are set up to support our commodity, our large, you know, large scale commodity sales. So, you know, farmers have moved into commodities over the last 40 years because that's what they've been encouraged to do. That's the path where they've been shown how to make a living. But those, the systems that we have set up right now, they don't necessarily, well, they certainly don't help with climate change. They aren't what farming used to look like. They don't need to be what farming looks like in the future. And quite frankly, they treat farmers as a middleman in between huge multinational corporations who are making quite a bit of money. So I think that if we had systems in place which encouraged farmers to grow more food that people directly eat, I think if we encouraged more farmers to do that, if we encouraged more farmers to plant cover crops, both financially, you know, changing where we as a government give money and support. What do we support as a government, as a people? Where do our dollars go? What is the farm bill actually doing? I think if we, there's a lot of room there to support farmers in doing things that are more beneficial for the planet. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that this is what Hot Farm dives into. It doesn't. I mean, we talk about these things in generalities. What we're showing is human stories, how people who are growing our food, what they're contending with. And I'm really hoping that people who make big policy decisions tune in, and that consumers tune in and demand food that is good for the climate, because it's all within our grasp. It's just we're not doing it.
We're going to have to take a quick break, but after that, we'll hear more from Eve Abrams, host of the new podcast, Hot Farm. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Dana Cronin, in for Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're joined by Eve Abrams. She's the host of the new podcast, Hot Farm, from the Food and Environment Reporting Network, that discusses climate change and agriculture here in the Midwest. So, Eve, the series goes from what farmers are or are not doing to fight climate change to what scientists and researchers are working on to combat climate change in this industry. And one big area of study is climate-friendly crops. In other words, what should farmers be planting to help combat climate change? I want to play a quick clip from episode 3, which features a crop called Kernza.
Right now, we have about 80 acres of Kernza.
When I visited Carmen's farm last August, he'd just completed his 10th Kernza harvest. Kernza still isn't growing at a size where it's a viable replacement for wheat, but Carmen's on-farm trial and error is getting it to that point. Carmen brought me out to his barn and opened up this big white plastic bag, like big enough that I could fit inside. He reached in, grabbed a fistful of Kernza kernels, and let them filter through his fingers. Kernza still doesn't mature to uniform sizes. Some kernels are bigger than others, but
if you look at that kernel,
Carmen points to one of the kernels in his palm, a little bigger than a grain of rice.
That's starting to approach the size of a wheat kernel. And when I started in 2011,
he points to another kernel, this one much smaller than most of the others.
That might have been the biggest kernel I had. So you look at that comparison.
Yeah, it looks so tiny compared to that one. It's like half the size.
Exactly. And that's the work that they've been able to do now.
Wow.
In this whole selecting process.
That was a clip from episode 3 of Hot Farm, which was reported and produced by Rachel Young. Eve, tell us more about Kernza and why you decided to focus on it for a whole episode.
Well, Kernza is a wheat grass. It's a relative of wheat, and scientists have been, you know, trying to, you know, develop Kernza, like, I mean, any crop that we eat is, you know, has been developed over hundreds or if not thousands of years, right? Wheat is in that category. I love thinking about this kind of thing. Corn is in that category. I mean, the staple, our grains are 70% of the world's croplands, and there are 50%, I believe it's 50% of the calories that human beings eat. And we've been cultivating these grains for thousands of years. And Kernza is new to the game. It's one that scientists are trying to jumpstart. So it's like they're applying like 23andMe, you know, like resources to Kernza to try to get it where it needs to go way faster than it would take for people to naturally cultivate a crop by natural selection. So the reason that Kernza is so beloved amongst the people who are, as Rachel, the producer of the show, calls the Kernza evangelists, is because not only does it have the potential to take the place of wheat, one of our staple crops, but unlike wheat, it's not an annual grain, it's a perennial grain. So again, it has these deep roots that are going to stick around in the earth for years and years and years. So there's no tilling involved. It can trap more carbon because of those deep roots and send that carbon deeper into the ground. It can stabilize the soil much better because of its really powerful deep roots. It can purify water because it slurps up fertilizer. So it's just this, it's like a super crop, really. And I think I was taken with people's enthusiasm for Kernza. And I had never heard of it before, or I'd heard of it, but I didn't really understand it. Let me say it that way. You know, it was a word that I'd heard, but didn't really understand what Kernza was, why, you know, why people were so excited about it. And this kind of sci-fi enthusiasm for how to grow something that could both feed us and save the planet, that was very, it was seductive, actually. I just was wowed by how other people felt about it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of our listeners, John, texted. He said, I have a small farm in Iowa, and for an industry that claims that they need to take care of the land because that's how they make their living, they show something approaching zero evidence of actually caring at all. Farming practices agencies around me in Illinois and Iowa are an abomination, not only because they hurt the land, but because they are uneconomic and essentially enslave the farmer to companies who provide inputs like ADM and Bayer Monsanto. Thank you for that message, John. I wonder, Eve, if you have any response to that.
Well, I think his language is very strident for good reason. You know, that's what I was talking about before, when I was talking about farmers being the middleman in between these multinational corporations. I mean, they are really like factory workers in a way. They're buying from companies in order to grow what they grow and then selling to different companies. And I think he's right. What I would say, though, is that when you're living in a system where everybody tells you this is the way you're supposed to do something, it's hard to think outside of the box. I mean, farmers do think outside of the box. Farmers have been doing different things, but you're really swimming upstream, and not everybody has the confidence or the tenacity or the means to try to pursue that. So I think that's why we should change how we're guiding farmers and how our system is built. And I think, you know, the scientists who are developing Kernza really hope that one of the answers is getting farmers to grow different crops that are less destructive to the planet. I mean, we still need to feed people. That's a reality. But how can we do it in a way that we're not cannibalizing our home, which is the earth? And I think that's what your listener was really pointing to. It's hard. I mean, Dave Bishop says this thing, which I love, that he quotes Earl Butz saying, get bigger, get out. And Dave chose a third option, which was get different. And I think anybody who isn't farming in the way that your listener described is because they're charting their own path. They're being different. And it shouldn't have to be that hard to do it. There are things, really practical things, we could do to make it easier for farmers to farm differently.
And speaking of farmers farming differently, you know, I wonder if the uptake in planting kernza is happening. I mean, when will we or will we see kernza on our grocery store shelves anytime soon, you think?
Oh, good question. I mean, there are little sprinkles of it there. You know, I think Rachel Young reported that story about kernza and did a beautiful, beautiful job. It's a great story. And she reports that Whole Foods named kernza one of its food trends for this year. There are kernza products, especially if you happen to live in Minnesota. So, but you know, check it out. Ask at your, you know, your grocery store, your food co-op. I think we're quite a bit away from having kernza create this food revolution. And again, people are not set up for it. It's a plant that's in development and it's, you know, it's hard to do something new. So I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball on this, but what I do know is that we need to try things because we depend on the earth and we're not treating it very well in the way that we grow our food and we need to eat. So we've been kind of kicking the can with climate change for quite some time, and it's finally reaching a point where that kicking of the can is very visceral, what the conclusion of that is. So it's exciting to me that there are people out there full of possibilities and ideas that they want to try. And I think that's what's exciting about Hot Farm, quite frankly. Climate change is not a happy topic. It is, things are not going in a positive direction any way you slice it, but this podcast is solutions focused. And so you're not going to come away from this podcast bummed out. I think to the contrary, you're going to see that there are lots of things that we can do. And hopefully you'll become part of the solution or urging the solution or at least knowledgeable about the solution so that we can demand that we do move in these directions that are, you know, realistically tackling these huge problems that are at our doorstep.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Eve Abrams, the host of the new podcast, Hot Farm. I'm Dana Cronin, in for Brian Mackey today. Eve, I want to talk about the last episode in the series, which is based on some fascinating research about the changing geography of certain crops, namely crops that have historically been grown in California, because thanks to climate change, California is becoming an increasingly difficult place to grow crops like artichokes and grapefruits, for example. But there are other areas in the country where those things could grow in the future, including the mid-Mississippi Delta. Eve, episode 4 of Hot Farm is called The New California. Tell us about it.
Yeah, love this one. Yes, so I remember reading the New York Times a couple months ago and seeing that water has become so scarce in California that California farmers, many of them, are selling their water to other farmers rather than planting crops, which to me is wild. We rely heavily on California for our food. We get at least a quarter of our food from California. So that is fruits and vegetables, and it's also a lot of nuts and, avocados are fruits. Yeah, so nuts and fruits and vegetables. Of course, other things come from California too. They have a robust dairy and meat industry as well. But because California is running out of water and because it plays such an outsized role in feeding the people who live both in this country and in other countries, again, we need to look at making resilient. We need to look at resilience. We need other supply chains. So California, the things that that California has going for it are this incredible growing climate, this Mediterranean climate, and then bountiful water. Well, where else is there bountiful water? All along the Mississippi. So Travis Lux, the reporter and producer on this episode, he traveled to the mid-Mississippi Delta to Arkansas, and he talk to folks who could be a model for what this might look like. That region of the country, like most of the farmland in our country, again, is mainly occupied with growing corn and soy. And what we really need for this to be actualized is for farmers in this region to dedicate some of their acreage to growing vegetables. Again, farmers aren't going to be willing to just, hey, all of a sudden, let me just risk making money this year and go into this whole new thing. No, they need supports. They need infrastructure. They need labor. You know, they need models. They need help to make this happen. And so this episode really dives into what that might look like. We profile a farmer who is doing it, Sean Peebles, and we talk about the hurdles he's faced and how he has surmounted them. And it's an exciting episode because, again, you know, it comes back to this idea that farming did not always look the way it looks right now in this country. It used to look really different. Farming used to be very diversified, and we moved away from that because we thought we can do things more efficiently and more cheaply this other way. Well, that's great until it's not great. And it's not great anymore.
Eve, what is your pitch to people who might have no interest in agriculture to listen to Hot Farm?
Do you like to eat? And you want? Do you want to keep eating? I mean, I love to eat. And I definitely want to keep eating. FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, who are, you know, the folks who made this podcast happen, I love the way they're writing about the podcast. They say, climate change is coming for your food. I can't say it any better than that. I mean, this is about eating. Farmers grow our food. And if you want to keep eating, I suggest you take an interest in where your food comes from and who is doing the noble work of growing it.
That's Eve Abrams, host of the new podcast Hot Farm from the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Eve, thank you so much.
Been a real pleasure, Dana. Thank you so much for diving into the story. And listeners, check out Hot Farm.
Episode 1 and 2 are available now wherever you get your podcasts. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey, Aiden Choate, and Erica Scalise, who is also our engagement producer. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Scalark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Dana Cronin, in for Brian Mackey today. Thank you so much for listening.